good chance that the idea came from Martine herself, or that she and her mother talked it over and came to a mutual agreement, which makes them both suicides in my book, even though it won't get written up that way in the official report. I assume you've checked on the other city center survivors, Hodges asks. All alive except for Gerald Stansberry, who died just after Thanksgiving last year, Pete says. Had a heart attack. His wife told me coronary disease runs in his family and that he lived longer than both his father and brother. Izzy's right. This is probably nothing, but I thought you and Holly should know. He looks at each of them in turn. You haven't had any bad thoughts about pulling the pin, have you? No, Hodges says. Not lately. Holly merely shakes her head, still looking down at the newspaper. Hodges asks, I don't suppose anyone found a mysterious letter Z in young Mr. Frias's bedroom after he and Ms. Countryman committed suicide? Of course not, Izzy says. That you know of, Hodges corrects. Isn't that what you mean? Considering you just found this one today? Jesus please us, Izzy says. This is silly. She looks pointedly at her watch and stands. Pete gets up, too. Holly remains seated, looking down at her filched copy of Inside View. Hodges also stays put, at least for the moment. You'll go back to the Frias Countryman photos, right, Pete? Check it out just to be sure? Yes, Pete says. And Izzy's probably right. I was silly to get you two out here. I'm glad you did. And I still feel bad about the way we handled Mrs. Trelawney, okay? Pete is looking at Hodges, but Hodges has an idea he's really speaking to the thin, pale woman with the junk newspaper in her lap. I never once doubted that she left her key in the ignition. I closed my mind to any other possibility. I promised myself I'd never do that again. I understand, Hodges says. One thing I believe we all can agree on, Izzy says, is that Hartsfield's days of running people down, blowing people up, and architecting suicides are behind him. So unless we've all stumbled into a movie called Son of Brady, I suggest we exit the late Ms. Ellerton's house and get on with our lives. Any objections to that idea? There are none. 7. Hodges and Holly stand in the driveway for a moment before getting into the car, letting the cold January wind rush past them. It's out of the north, blowing straight down from Canada, so the usually present smell of the large polluted lake to the east is refreshingly absent. There are only a few houses at this end of Hilltop Court, and the closest has a for sale sign on it. Hodges notices that Tom Saubers is the agent, and he smiles. Tom was also badly hurt in the massacre, but has come almost all the way back. Hodges is always amazed by the resilience of which some men and women are capable. It doesn't exactly give him hope for the human race, but actually it does. In the car, Holly puts the folded Inside View on the floor long enough to fasten her seatbelt, then picks it up again. Neither Pete nor Isabel objected to her taking it. Hodges isn't sure they even noticed. Why would they? To them, the Ellerton house isn't really a crime scene, although the letter of the law may call it that. Pete was uneasy, true, but Hodges thinks that had little to do with cop intuition and was a quasi-superstitious response instead. Hartsfield should have died when Holly hit him with my happy slapper, Hodges thinks. That would have been better for all of us. Pete will go back and look at the pictures from the Frias Countryman suicides, he tells Holly. Due diligence and all that. But if he finds a Z scratch somewhere, on a baseboard, on a mirror, I will be one surprised human being. She doesn't reply. Her eyes are far away. Holly? Are you there? She starts a little.
Yes. Just planning how I'll locate Nancy Alderson in Chagrin Falls. It shouldn't take too long with all the search programs I've got, but you'll have to talk to her. I can do cold calls now if I absolutely have to, you know that.
Yes, you've gotten good at it. Which is true, although she always makes such calls with her trusty box of Nicorette close at hand, not to mention a stash of Twinkies in her desk for backup.
But I can't be the one to tell her that her employers, her friends, for all we know, are dead. You'll have to do it. You're good at things like that.
Hodges feels that nobody is very good at things like that, but doesn't bother saying so. Why? The Alderson woman wouldn't have been there since last Friday.
She deserves to know, Holly says. The police will get in touch with any relatives. That's their job. But they're not going to call the housekeeper. At least, I don't think so.
Hodges doesn't either, and Holly's right. The Alderson woman deserves to know, if only so she doesn't turn up to find an X of police tape on the door. But somehow he doesn't think that's Holly's only interest in Nancy Alderson.
Your friend Pete and Miss Pretty Gray Eyes hardly did anything, Holly says. There was fingerprint powder in Martine Stover's bedroom, sure, and on her wheelchair, and in the bathroom where Mrs. Ellerton killed herself, but none upstairs where she slept. They probably went up long enough to make sure there wasn't a body stashed under the bed or in the closet and called it good.
Hold on a second. You went upstairs?
Of course. Somebody needed to investigate thoroughly, and those two sure weren't doing it. As far as they're concerned, they know exactly what happened. Pete only called you because he was spooked.
Spooked. Yes, that was it. Exactly the word he was looking for and hadn't been able to find.
I was spooked, too, Holly says matter-of-factly. But that doesn't mean I lost my wits. The whole thing was wrong. Wrong, 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 and you need to talk to the housekeeper. I'll tell you what to ask her if you can't figure it out for yourself.
Is this about the Z on the bathroom counter? If you know something I don't, I wish you'd fill me in.
It's not what I know. It's what I saw. Didn't you notice what was beside that Z?
A magic marker.
She gives him a look that says, you can do better.
Hodges calls on an old cop technique that comes in especially handy when giving trial testimony. He looks at the picture again, this time in his mind. There was a power cord plugged into the wall beside the basin.
Yes. At first, I thought it must be for an e-reader, and Mrs. Ellerton left it plugged in there because she spent most of her time in that part of the house. It would be a convenient charging point, because all the plugs in Martine's bedroom were probably in use for her life support gear. Don't you think so?
Yeah, that could be.
Only I have both a Nook and a Kindle.
Of course you do, he thinks.
And neither of them has cords like that. Those cords are black. This one was gray.
Maybe she lost the original charging cord and bought a replacement at Tech Village. Pretty much the only game in town for electronic supplies now that Discount Electronics, Brady Hartsfield's old employer, has declared bankruptcy.
No, e-readers have prong-type plugins. This one was wider, like for an electronic tablet. Only my iPad also has that kind, and the one in the bathroom was much smaller. That cord was for some kind of handheld device, so I went upstairs to look for it.
Where you found?
Just an old PC on a desk by the window in Mrs. Ellerton's bedroom. And I mean old. It was hooked up to a modem.
Oh, my God, no, Hodges exclaims. Not a modem.
This is not funny, Bill. Those women are dead.
Hodges takes a hand from the wheel and holds it up in a peace gesture. Sorry, go on. This is a part where you tell me you powered up her computer.
Holly looks slightly discomforted. Well, yes. But only in the service of an investigation the police are clearly not going to make. I wasn't snooping.
Hodges could argue the point, but doesn't.
It wasn't password protected, so I looked at Mrs. Ellerton's search history. She visited quite a few retail sites, and lots of medical sites having to do with paralysis. She seemed very interested in stem cells, which makes sense, considering her daughter's condition.
You did all this in 10 minutes?
I'm a fast reader. But you know what I didn't find?
I'm guessing anything to do with suicide.
Yes. So how did she know about the helium thing? For that matter, how did she know how to dissolve those pills in vodka and put them in her daughter's feeding tube?
Well, Hodges says, there's this ancient arcane ritual called reading books. You may have heard of it.
Did you see any books in that living room?
He replays the living room just as he did the photo of Martine Stover's bathroom, and Holly is right. There were shelves of knick-knacks and that picture of big-eyed waifs in the flat-screen TV. There were magazines on the coffee table, but spread in a way that spoke more to decoration than to voracious reading. Plus, none of them was exactly the Atlantic Monthly. No, he says. No books in the living room, although I saw a couple in the photo of Stover's bedroom. One of them looked like a Bible. He glances at the folded inside view in her lap. What have you got in there, Holly? What are you hiding? When Holly flushes, she goes totally DEFCON 1, the blood crashing to her face in a way that's alarming. It happens now.
It wasn't stealing, she says. It was borrowing. I never steal, Bill. Never.
Cool your jets. What is it?
The thing that goes with the power cord in the bathroom.
She unfolds the newspaper to reveal a bright pink gadget with a dark gray screen. It's bigger than an e-reader, smaller than an electronic tablet.
When I came downstairs, I sat in Mrs. Ellerton's chair to think a minute. I ran my hands between the arms and the cushion. I wasn't even hunting for something. I was just doing it.
One of Holly's many self-comforting techniques, Hodges assumes. He's seen many in the years since he first met her in the company of her overprotective mother and aggressively gregarious uncle. In their company? No, not exactly. That phrase suggested equality. Charlotte Gibney and Henry Seroy had treated her more like a mentally defective child out on a day pass. Holly is a different woman now, but traces of the old Holly still remain, and that's okay with Hodges. After all, everyone casts a shadow.
That's where it was, down on the right side. It's a Zappit.
The name chimes a faint chord far back in his memory, although when it comes to computer chip-driven gadgetry, Hodges is far behind the curve. He's always screwing up with his own home computer, and now that Jerome Robinson is away, Holly is the one who usually comes over to his house on Harper Road to straighten him out. What's it?
A Zappit Commander. I've seen advertisements online, although not lately. They come preloaded with over 100 simple electronic games, like Tetris, Simon, and Spell Tower. Nothing complicated like Grand Theft Auto. So tell me what it was doing there, Bill. Tell me what it was doing in a house where one of the women was almost 80 and the other one couldn't turn on a light switch, let alone play video games.
It seems odd, all right. Not downright bizarre, but on the odd side for sure.
And the cord was plugged in right next to that letter Z, she says. Not Z for the end, like a suicide note, but Z for Zappit. At least that's what I think.
Hodges considers the idea. Maybe. He wonders again if he has encountered that name before, or if it's only what the French call faux souvenir, a false memory. He could swear it has some connection to Brady Hartsfield, but he can't trust that idea because Brady is very much on his mind today. How long has it been since I've gone to visit him? 6 months? 8? No, longer than that. Quite a bit longer. The last time was not long after the business having to do with Pete Sauber's and the cache of stolen money and notebooks Pete discovered, practically buried in his backyard. On that occasion, Hodges found Brady much the same as ever, a gorked-out young man dressed in a plaid shirt and jeans that never got dirty. He was sitting in the same chair he was always sitting in when Hodges visited room 217 in the brain injury clinic, just staring out at the parking garage across the way. The only real difference that day had been outside room 217. Becky Helmington, the head nurse, had moved on to the surgical wing of Kiner Memorial, thereby closing Hodges' conduit to rumors about Brady. The new head nurse was a woman with stony scruples and a face like a closed fist. Ruth Scapelli refused Hodges' offer of $50 for any little tidbits about Brady and threatened to report him if he ever offered her money for patient information again.
"You're not even on his visitors list," she said.
"I don't want information about him," Hodges had said. "I've got all the information about Brady Hartsfield I'm ever going to need. I just want to know what the staff is saying about him, because there have been rumors, you know, some of them pretty wild."
Scapelli favored him with a disdainful look.
"There's loose talk in every hospital, Mr. Hodges, and always about patients who are famous, or infamous, as is the case with Mr. Hartsfield. I held a staff meeting shortly after Nurse Helmington moved from brain injury to her current situation, and informed my people that the talk about Mr. Hartsfield was to stop immediately, and if I caught wind of more rumors, I would trace them to their source and see that the person or persons spreading them was dismissed. As for you," looking down her nose at him, the fist of her face tightening even more. I can't believe that a former police officer, and a decorated one at that, would resort to bribery.
Not long after that rather humiliating encounter, Holly and Jerome Robinson cornered him and staged a mini-intervention telling Hodges that his visits to Brady had to end. Jerome had been especially serious that day, his usual cheerful patter nowhere to be found. "There's nothing you can do in that room but hurt yourself," Jerome had said. "We always know when you've been to see him because you go around with a little gray cloud over your head for the next 2 days."
"More like a week," Holly added.
She wouldn't look at him, and she was twisting her fingers in a way that made Hodges want to grab them and make her stop before she broke something. Her voice, however, was firm and sure.
"There's nothing left inside him, Bill. You need to accept that. And if there was, he'd be happy every time you showed up. He'd see what he's doing to you and be happy."
That was the convincer, because Hodges knew it was the truth. So he stays away. It was kind of like quitting smoking, hard at first, easier as time went by. Now whole weeks sometimes pass without thoughts of Brady and Brady's terrible crimes. There's nothing left inside him. Hodges reminds himself of that as he drives back into the heart of the city, where Holly will kick her computer into high gear and start hunting down Nancy Alderson. Whatever happened in that house at the end of Hilltop Court, the chain of thoughts and conversations, of tears and promises, all ending in the dissolved pills injected into the feeding tube and the tank of helium with the laughing children decaled on the side, it can have nothing to do with Brady Hartsfield, because Holly literally bashed his brains out. If Hodges sometimes doubts, it's because he can't stand the idea that Brady has somehow escaped punishment, that in the end, the monster eluded him. Hodges didn't even get to swing the ball-bearing loaded sock he calls his happy slapper because he was busy suffering a heart attack at the time. Still, a ghost of memory. Zap it. He knows he has heard that before. His stomach gives a warning twinge, and he remembers the doctor's appointment he blew off. He'll have to take care of that, but tomorrow should be soon enough. He has an idea that Dr. Stamos is going to tell him he has an ulcer, and for that news he can wait. 8. Holly has a fresh box of Nicorette by her telephone, but doesn't need to use a single chew. The first Alderson she calls turns out to be the housekeeper's sister-in-law, who of course wants to know why someone from a company called Finders Keepers wants to get in touch with Nan.
"Is it a bequest or something?" she asks hopefully.
"One moment," Holly says. "I have to put you on hold while I get my boss."
Hodges is not her boss. He made her a full partner after the Pete Salbers business last year. But it's a fiction she often falls back on when she's stressed. Hodges, who has been using his own computer to read up on Zap-It game systems, picks up the phone while Holly lingers by his desk, gnawing at the neck of her sweater. Hodges hovers his finger over the hold button on his phone long enough to tell Holly that eating wool probably isn't good for her, and certainly not for the fair isle she's wearing. Then he connects with the sister-in-law. "I'm afraid I have some bad news for Nancy," he says, and fills her in quickly.
"Oh, my God," Linda Alderson says.
Holly has jotted the name on his pad.
"She's going to be devastated to hear that, and not just because it means the end of the job. She's been working for those ladies since 2012, and she really likes them. She had Thanksgiving dinner with them just last November. Are you with the police?"
"Retired," he says, "but working with the team assigned to the case. I was asked to get in touch with Ms. Alderson." He doesn't think this lie will come back to haunt him since Pete opened the door by inviting him to the scene. "Can you tell me how to get in touch with her?"
"I'll give you her cell number. She went to Chagrin Falls for her brother's birthday party on Saturday. It was the big 4-0, so Harry's wife made a fuss about it. She's staying until Wednesday or Thursday, I think. At least that was the plan. I'm sure this news will bring her back. Nan lives alone since Bill died. Bill was my husband's brother, with only her cat for company. Mrs. Ellerton and Ms. Stover were sort of a surrogate family. This will just make her so sad."
Hodges takes the number down and calls immediately. Nancy Alderson picks up on the first ring. He identifies himself, then gives her the news. After a moment of shocked silence, she says,
"Oh, no, that can't be. You've made a mistake, Detective Hodges."
He doesn't bother to correct her, because this is interesting. Why do you say that?
Because they're happy. They get along so well, watching TV together. They love movies on the DVD player, and those shows about cooking, or where women sit around talking about fun things and having celebrity guests. You wouldn't believe it, but there's a lot of laughter in that house.
Nancy Alderson hesitates, then says,
Are you sure you're talking about the right people? About Jan Ellerton and Marty Stover?
Sorry to say I am.
But she had accepted her condition. Marty, I'm talking about, Martine. She used to say that getting used to being paralyzed was actually easier than getting used to being a spinster. She and I used to talk about that all the time, being on our own, because I lost my husband, you know.
So, there was never a Mr. Stover?
Yes, there was. Janice had an earlier marriage. Very short, I believe, but she said she never regretted it because she got Martine. Marty did have a boyfriend not long before her accident, but he had a heart attack. Carried him right off. Marty said he was very fit, used to exercise 3 days a week at a health club downtown. She said it was being so fit that killed him, because his heart was strong, and when it backfired, it just blew apart.
Hodges, a coronary survivor, thinks, reminder to self, no fitness club.
Marty used to say that being alone after someone you love passes on was the worst kind of paralysis. I didn't feel exactly the same way about my Bill, but I knew what she meant. Reverend Hinreed came in to see her often. Marty calls him her spiritual advisor. And even when he didn't, she and Jan did daily devotions and prayers, every day at noon. And Marty was thinking about taking an accounting course online. They have special courses for people with her kind of disability. Did you know that?
I didn't, Hodges says. On his pad he prints, Stover planning to take accounting course by computer and turns it so Holly can read it. She raises her eyebrows.
There were tears and sadness from time to time, of course there was, but for the most part they were happy. At least, I don't know.
What are you thinking about, Nancy? He makes the switch to her first name, another old cop trick without thinking about it.
Oh, it's probably nothing. Marty seemed as happy as ever. She's a real love bug, that one. You wouldn't believe how spiritual she is. Always sees the good side of everything. But Jan did seem a little withdrawn lately, as if she had something weighing on her mind. I thought it might be money worries, or maybe just the after-Christmas blues. I never dreamed.
She sniffles.
Excuse me, I have to blow.
Sure. Holly grabs his pad. Her printing is small, constipated, he often thinks, and he has to hold the pad almost touching his nose to read, Ask her about Zappit. There's a honking sound in his ear as Alderson blows her nose.
Sorry.
That's all right, Nancy. Would you know if Mrs. Ellerton happened to have a small handheld game console? It would have been pink.
Goodness sakes, how did you know that?
I really don't know anything, Hodges says truthfully. I'm just a retired detective with a list of questions I'm supposed to ask.
She said a man gave it to her. He told her the game gadget was free as long as she promised to fill out a questionnaire and send it back to the company. The thing was a little bit bigger than a paperback book. It just sat around the house a while.
When was this?
I can't remember exactly, but before Christmas for sure. The first time I saw it, it was on the coffee table in the living room. It just stayed there with the questionnaire folded up beside it until after Christmas. I know because their little tree was gone. And then I spied it one day on the kitchen table. Jan said she'd turned it on just to see what it would do, and found out there were solitaire games on it, maybe as many as a dozen different kinds, like Klondike, and Picture, and Pyramid. So, since she was using it, she filled out the questionnaire and sent it in.
Did she charge it in Marty's bathroom?
Yes, because that was the most convenient place. She was in that part of the house so much, you know.
Uh-huh. You said that Mrs. Ellerton became withdrawn.
A little withdrawn,
Alderson corrects at once.
Mostly she was the same as always. A love bug, just like Marty.
But something was on her mind.
Yes, I think so.
Weighing on her mind.
Well,
was this around the same time she got the handheld game machine?
I guess it was, now that I think about it. But why in the world would playing solitaire on a little pink tablet depress her?
I don't know, Hodges says, and prints depressed on his bed. He thinks there's a significant jump between being withdrawn and being depressed.
Have their relations been told? Alderson asks. There aren't any in the city, but there are cousins in Ohio, I know that. And I think some in Kansas, too. Or maybe it was Indiana. The names would be in her address book.
The police will be doing that as we speak, Hodges says, although he will call Pete later on to make sure. It will probably annoy his old partner, but Hodges doesn't care. Nancy Alderson's distress is in every word she utters, and he wants to offer what comfort he can. May I ask one more question?
Of course.
Did you happen to notice anyone hanging around the house, anyone without an obvious reason to be there? Holly is nodding vigorously.
Why would you ask that?
Alderson sounds astonished.
Surely you don't think some outsider...
I don't think anything, Hodges says smoothly. I'm just helping the police because there's been such a staff reduction in the last few years. Citywide budget cuts.
I know. It's awful.
So they gave me this list of questions, and that's the last one.
Well, there was nobody. I'd have noticed because of the breezeway between the house and the garage. The garage is heated, so that's where the pantry and the washer-dryer are. I'm back and forth in that breezeway all the time, and I can see the street from there. Hardly anyone comes all the way up Hilltop Court because Jan and Marty's is the last house. It's just the turnaround after that. Of course, there's the postman and UPS and sometimes FedEx, but otherwise, unless someone gets lost, we've got that end of the street to ourselves.
So there was no one at all?
No, sir, there sure wasn't.
Not the man who gave Mrs. Ellerton the game console?
No. He approached her in Ridgeline Foods. That's the grocery store at the foot of the hill down where City Avenue crosses Hilltop Court. There's a Kroger about a mile further on in the City Avenue Plaza, but Janice won't go there even though things are a little cheaper, because she says you should always buy locally if you...
She gives a sudden loud sob.
But she's done shopping anywhere, isn't she? Oh, I can't believe this. Jan would never hurt Marty, not for the world.
It's a sad thing, Hodges says.
I'll have to come back today.
Alderson now talking to herself rather than to Hodges.
It may take a while for her relatives to come, and someone will have to make the proper arrangements.
A final housekeeping duty, Hodges thinks, and finds the thought both touching and obscurely horrible. I want to thank you for your time, Nancy. I'll let you go now.
Of course there was that elderly fellow,
Alderson says. What elderly fellow was that?
I saw him several times outside 1588. He'd park at the curb and just stand on the sidewalk, looking at it. That's the house across the street and down the hill a little way. You might not have noticed it, but it was for sale.
Hodges did notice, but doesn't say so. He doesn't want to interrupt.
Once, he walked right up the lawn to look in the bay window. This was before the last big snowstorm. I think he was window shopping.
She gives a watery laugh.
Although my mother would have called it window wishing, because he surely didn't look like the sort who could afford a house like that.
No?
Uh-uh. He was dressed in workman's clothes. You know, green pants like Dickie's. And his parka was mended with a piece of masking tape. Also, his car looked very old, and had spots of primer on it. My late husband used to call that poor man's polish.
You don't happen to know what kind of car it was, do you? He flips his pad to a fresh sheet and writes, "Fine date of last big snowstorm." Holly reads it and nods.
No, I'm sorry. I don't know cars. I don't even remember the color, just those spots of primer paint. Mr. Hodges, are you sure there hasn't been some mistake?
She's almost begging. I wish I could tell you that, Nancy, but I can't. You've been very helpful. Doubtfully.
Have I?
Hodges gives her his number, Holly's, and the office number. He tells her to call if anything occurs to her that they haven't covered. He reminds her that there may be press interest because Martine was paralyzed at City Center in 2009, and tells her she isn't obliged to talk to reporters or TV news people if she doesn't want to. Nancy Alderson is crying again when he breaks the connection. 9. He takes Holly to lunch at Panda Garden, a block down the street. It's early, and they have the dining room almost to themselves. Holly is off meat and orders vegetable chow mein. Hodges loves the spicy shredded beef, but his stomach won't put up with it these days, so he settles for ma-la lamb. They both use chopsticks. Holly, because she's good with them, and Hodges, because they slow him down and make a post-lunch bonfire in his guts less likely.
She says, "The last big storm was December 19th. The Weather Service reported 11 inches in Government Square, 13 in Branson Park. Not exactly huge, but the only other one so far this winter dropped just 4 inches.
6 days before Christmas. Around the same time Janice Allerton was given the Zap-It, according to Alderson's recollection.
Do you think the man who gave it to her was the same one looking at that house?"
Hodges snares a piece of broccoli. "It's supposed to be good for you, like all veggies that taste bad. I don't think Allerton would have accepted anything from a guy wearing a parka mended with masking tape. I'm not counting the possibility out, but it seems unlikely."
"Eat your lunch, Bill. If I get any further ahead of you, I'll look like a pig."
Hodges eats, although he has very little appetite these days, even when his stomach isn't giving him the devil. When a bite sticks in his throat, he washes it down with tea. Maybe a good idea, since tea seems to help. He thinks about those test results he has yet to see. It occurs to him that his problem could be worse than an ulcer, that an ulcer might actually be the best-case scenario. There's medicine for ulcers. Other things, not so much. When he can see the middle of his plate, but Jesus, so much food left around the edges, he sets his chopsticks aside and says, "I found something out while you were hunting down Nancy Alderson."
"Tell me."
"I was reading about those Zap-Its. Amazing how these computer-based companies pop up then disappear. They're like dandelions in June. The commander didn't exactly corner the market. Too simple, too expensive, too much sophisticated competition. Zap-It Inc. stock went down, and they got bought out by a company called Sunrise Solutions. 2 years ago, that company declared bankruptcy and went dark, which means Zap-It is long gone and the guy giving out commander consoles had to be running some kind of scam."
Holly is quick to see where that leads. "So the questionnaire was bull poop, just to add a little, what do you call it, verisimilitude. But the guy didn't try to get money out of her, did he?"
"No, at least not that we know of."
"Something weird is going on here, Bill. Are you going to tell Detective Huntley and Miss Pretty Gray Eyes?"
Hodges has picked up the smallest piece of lamb left on his plate, and here is an excuse to drop it. "Why don't you like her, Holly?"
"Well, she thinks I'm crazy,"
Holly says matter-of-factly.
"There's that."
"I'm sure she doesn't."
"Yes, she does. She probably thinks I'm dangerous, too, because of the way I whopped Brady Hartsfield at the Round Here concert. But I don't care. I'd do it again 1,000 times.
He puts a hand over hers. The chopstick she's holding in her fist vibrate like a tuning fork. "I know you would, and you'd be right every time. You saved 1,000 lives, and that's a conservative estimate."
She slides her hand from beneath his and starts picking up grains of rice. "Oh, I can deal with her thinking I'm crazy. I've been dealing with people thinking that all my life, starting with my parents. But there's something else. Isabel only sees what she sees, and she doesn't like people who see more, or at least look for more. She feels the same way about you, Bill. She's jealous of you, over Pete."
Hodges says nothing. He's never considered such a possibility. She puts down her chopsticks.
"You didn't answer my question. Are you going to tell them what we've learned so far?"
"Not quite yet. There's something I want to do first, if you'll hold down the office this afternoon."
Holly smiles down at the remainder of her chow mein. "I always do."
10. Bill Hodges isn't the only one who took an instant dislike to Becky Helmington's replacement. The nurses and orderlies who work in the traumatic brain injury clinic call it the bucket, as in brain bucket. And before long, Ruth Scapelli has become known as Nurse Ratchet. By the end of her 3rd month, she has gotten 3 nurses transferred for various small infractions and 1 orderly fired for smoking in a supply closet. She has banned certain colorful uniforms as too distracting or too suggestive. The doctors like her, though.
they find her swift and competent. With the patients, she is also swift and competent. But she's cold, and there's an undertone of contempt there as well. She will not allow even the most cataclysmically injured of them to be called a gork, or a burn, or a wipeout, at least not in her hearing. But she has a certain attitude. She knows her stuff, one nurse said to another in the break room not long after Scapelli took up her duties. No argument about that, but there's something missing. The other nurse was a 30-year veteran who had seen it all. She considered, then said one word, but it was le mot juste. Mercy. Scapelli never exhibits coldness or contempt when she accompanies Felix Babineau, the head of neuro, on his rounds, and he probably wouldn't notice if she did. Some of the other doctors have noticed, but few pay any mind. The doings of such lesser beings as nurses, even head nurses, are far below their lordly gaze. It is as if Scapelli feels that, no matter what is wrong with them, the patients of the traumatic brain injury clinic must bear part of the responsibility for their current condition, and if they only tried harder, they would surely regain at least some of their faculties. She does her job, though, and for the most part she does it well, perhaps better than Becky Helmington, who was far better liked. If told this, Scapelli would have said, she was not here to be liked. She was here to care for her patients, end of story, full stop. There is, however, one long-term patient in the bucket whom she hates. That patient is Brady Hartsfield. It isn't because she had a friend or relative who was hurt or killed at City Center. It's because she thinks he's shamming, avoiding the punishment he so richly deserves. Mostly she stays away and lets other staff members deal with him, because just seeing him often infuses her with a day-long rage that the system should be so easily gamed by this vile creature. She stays away for another reason, too. She doesn't entirely trust herself when she's in his room. On two occasions she has done something, the kind of thing that, were it discovered, might result in her being the one fired. But on this early January afternoon, just as Hodges and Holly are finishing their lunch, she is drawn down to room 217 as if by an invisible cable. Only this morning she was forced to go in there because Dr. Babineau insists she accompany him on rounds and Brady is his star patient. He marvels at how far Brady has come.
He should never have emerged from his coma at all, Babineau told her shortly after she came on staff at the bucket.
He's a cold fish, but when he speaks of Brady, he becomes almost jolly.
And look at him now. He's able to walk short distances, with help, I grant you. He can feed himself, and he can respond either verbally or with signs to simple questions.
He's also prone to poking himself in the eye with his fork, Ruth Scapelli could have added, but doesn't. And his verbal responses all sound like wah-wah and gub-gub to her. Then there's the matter of waste. Put a depends on him, and he holds it. Take it off, and he urinates in his bed, regular as clockwork. Defecates in it if he can. It's as if he knows. She believes he does know. Something else he knows, of this there can be no doubt, is that Scapelli doesn't like him. This very morning, after the exam was finished and Dr. Babineau was washing his hands in the ensuite bathroom, Brady raised his head to look at her and lifted one hand to his chest. He curled it into a loose, trembling fist. From it, his middle finger slowly extended. At first, Scapelli could barely comprehend what she was seeing. Brady Hartsfield giving her the finger. Then, as she heard the water go off in the bathroom, two buttons popped from the front of her uniform, exposing the center of her sturdy Playtex 18-hour comfort strap bra. She doesn't believe the rumors she's heard about this waste of humanity, refuses to believe them. But then he smiled at her, grinned at her. Now, she walks down to room 217 while soothing music wafts from the speakers overhead. She's wearing her spare uniform, the pink one she keeps in her locker and doesn't like much. She looks both ways to make sure no one is paying any attention to her,
pretends to study Brady's chart just in case there's a set of prying eyes she's missed, and slips inside. Brady sits in his chair by the window where he always sits. He's dressed in one of his four plaid shirts and a pair of jeans. His hair has been combed, and his cheeks are baby smooth. A button on his breast pocket proclaims, "I was shaved by Nurse Barbara." He's living like Donald Trump, Ruth Scapelli thinks. He killed 8 people and wounded God knows how many more. He tried to kill thousands of teenage girls at a rock and roll concert, and here he sits with his meals brought to him by his own personal staff, his clothes laundered, his face shaved. He gets a massage 3 times a week. He visits the spa 4 times a week and spends time in the hot tub. Living like Donald Trump, more like a desert chieftain in one of those oil-rich Mideast countries. And if she told Babineau that he gave her the finger? "Oh, no," he'd say. "Oh, no, Nurse Scapelli. What you saw was nothing but an involuntary muscle twitch." He's still incapable of the thought processes that would lead to such a gesture. Even if that were not the case, why would he make such a gesture to you? "Because you don't like me," she says, bending forward with her hands on her pink-skirted knees. "Do you, Mr. Hartsfield? And that makes us even, because I don't like you." He doesn't look at her or give any sign that he's heard her. He only looks out the window at the parking garage across the way. But he does hear her. She's sure he does. And his failure to acknowledge her in any way infuriates her more. When she talks, people are supposed to listen. "Am I to believe you popped the buttons on my uniform this morning by some kind of mind control?" "Nothing. I know better. I'd been meaning to replace that one. The bodice was a bit too tight. You may fool some of the more credulous staff members, but you don't fool me, Mr. Hartsfield. All you can do is sit there and make a mess in your bed every time you get the chance." "Nothing." She glances around at the door to make sure it's shut, then removes her left hand from her knee and reaches out with it. "All those people you hurt, some of them still suffering, does that make you happy?" "It does, doesn't it? How would you like it? Shall we find out?" She first touches the soft ridge of a nipple beneath his shirt, then grasps it between her thumb and index finger. Her nails are short, but she digs in with what she has. She twists first one way, then the other. "That's pain, Mr. Hartsfield. Do you like it?" His face remains as bland as ever, which makes her angrier still. She bends closer until their noses are almost touching. Her face more like a fist than ever. Her blue eyes bulge behind her glasses. There are tiny spit buds at the corners of her lips. "I could do this to your testicles," she whispers. "Perhaps I will." Yes, she just might. It's not as if he can tell Babineau, after all. He has 4 dozen words at most, and few people can understand what he does manage to say. "I want more corn," comes out, "a one ma ko," which sounds like fake Indian talk in an old Western movie. The only thing he says that's perfectly clear is, "I want my mother." And on several occasions, Scapelli has taken great pleasure in reinforming him that his mother's dead. She twists his nipple back and forth, clockwise and counterclockwise, pinching as hard as she can. And her hands are nurse's hands, which means they are strong. "You think Dr. Babineau is your pet, but you've got that backwards. You're his pet. His pet guinea pig. He thinks I don't know about the experimental drugs he's been giving you, but I do. Vitamins," he says. "Vitamins, my fanny. I know everything that goes on around here. He thinks he's going to bring you all the way back. But that will never happen. You're too far gone. And what if it did? You'd stand trial and go to jail for the rest of your life. And they don't have hot tubs in Waynesville State Prison.
She's pinching his nipples so hard the tendons on her wrist stand out, and he still shows no sign that he feels anything.
Just looks out at the parking garage, his face a blank.
If she keeps on, one of the nurses is apt to see bruising swelling and it will go on his chart. She lets go and steps back, breathing hard, and the Venetian blind at the top of his window gives an abrupt bone-like rattle. The sound makes her jump and look around. When she turns back to him, Hartsfield is no longer looking at the parking garage. He's looking at her. His eyes are clear and aware. Scapelli feels a bright spark of fear and takes a step back. "I could report Babineau," she says, "but doctors have a way of wiggling out of things, especially when it's their word against a nurse's, even a head nurse's. And why would I? Let him experiment on you all he wants. Even Waynesville is too good for you, Mr. Hartsfield. Maybe he'll give you something that will kill you. That's what you deserve." A food trolley rumbles by in the corridor. Someone is getting a late lunch. Ruth Scapelli jerks like a woman awaking from a dream and backs toward the door, looking from Hartsfield to the now silent Venetian blind and then back to Hartsfield again.
"I'll leave you to your thoughts, but I want to tell you one more thing before I go. If you ever show me your middle finger again, it will be your testicles."
Brady's hand rises from his lap to his chest. It trembles, but that's a motor control issue. Thanks to 10 sessions a week downstairs in physical therapy, he's gotten at least some muscle tone back. Scapelli stares, unbelieving, as the middle finger rises and tilts toward her. With it comes that obscene grin.
"You're a freak," she says in a low voice. "An aberration." But she doesn't approach him again. She's suddenly, irrationally afraid of what might happen if she did.
11. Tom Saubers is more than willing to do the favor Hodges has asked of him, even though it means rescheduling a couple of afternoon appointments. He owes Bill Hodges a lot more than a tour through an empty house up in Ridgedale. After all, the ex-cop, with the help of his friends Holly and Jerome, saved the lives of his son and daughter, possibly his wife's as well. He punches off the alarm in the foyer, reading the numbers from a slip of paper clipped to the folder he carries. As he leads Hodges through the downstairs rooms, their footfalls echoing, Tom can't help going into his spiel. Yes, it's quite a long way out from the city center. Can't argue the point. But what that means is you get all the city services, water, plowing, garbage removal, school buses, municipal buses, without all the city noise. "The place is cable-ready and way above code," he says. "Great, but I don't want to buy it." Tom looks at him curiously. "What do you want?" Hodges sees no reason not to tell him.
"To know if anyone has been using it to keep an eye on that house across the street. There was a murder-suicide there this past weekend."
"In 1601?
Jesus, Bill, that's awful." "It is," Hodges thinks, "and I believe you're already wondering who you should talk to about becoming the selling agent on that one." Not that he holds that against the man who went through his own hell as a result of the city center massacre. "So you've left the cane behind," Hodges comments as they climb to the second floor.
"I sometimes use it at night, especially if the weather's rainy," Tom says. "The scientists claim that stuff about your joints hurting more in wet weather is bullshit, but I'm here to tell you that's one old wives' tale you can take to the bank. Now, this is the master bedroom, and you can see how it's set up to catch the morning light. The bathroom is nice and big. The shower has pulsing jets, and just down the hall here..."
"Yes, it's a fine house. Hodges would expect nothing else here in Ridgedale, but there's no sign anyone has been in it lately."
"Seen enough?" Tom asks.
"I think so, yes. Did you notice anything out of place?"
"Not a thing. And the alarm is a good one. If someone had broken in..."
"Yeah," Hodges says. "Sorry to get you out on such a cold day."
"Nonsense. I had to be out and about anyway. And it's good to see you."
They step out the kitchen door, which Tom relocks.
"Although you're looking awfully thin."
"Well, you know what they say. You can't be too thin or too rich."
Tom, who in the wake of his city center injuries was too thin and too poor,
gives this oldie an obligatory smile and starts around to the front of the house. Hodges follows a few steps, then stops.
Could we look in the garage?
Sure, but there's nothing in there.
Just a peek.
Cross every T and dot every I, huh? Roger that. Just let me get the right key.
Only he doesn't need the key because the garage door is standing 2 inches ajar.
The two men look at the splinters around the lock silently. At last, Tom says, "Well, how about that?"
The alarm system doesn't cover the garage, I take it.
You take it right. There's nothing to protect.
Hodges steps into a rectangle with bare wood walls and a poured concrete floor. There are boot prints visible on the concrete.
Hodges can see his breath, and he can see something else as well.
In front of the left overhead door is a chair. Someone sat here, looking out.
Hodges has been feeling a growing discomfort on the left side of his midsection, one that's putting out tentacles that curl around to his lower back, but this sort of pain is almost an old friend by now, and it's temporarily overshadowed by excitement.
Someone sat here looking out at 1601, he thinks. I'd bet the farm on it, if I had a farm. He walks to the front of the garage and sits where the watcher sat. There are three windows running horizontally across the middle of the door, and the one on the far right has been wiped clean of dust. The view is a straight shot to the big living room window of 1601.
"Hey, Bill," Tom says. "Something under the chair."
Hodges bends to look, although doing so turns up the heat in his gut. What he sees is a black disc, maybe 3 inches across. He picks it up by the edges. Embossed on it in gold is a single word, Steiner.
"Is it from a camera?" Tom asks.
"From a pair of binoculars. Police departments with fat budgets use Steiner binocs." With a good pair of Steiners, and as far as Hodges knows, there's no such thing as a bad pair, the watcher could have put himself right into the Ellerton-Stover living room, assuming the blinds were up. And they had been when he and Holly were in that room this morning. Hell, if the women had been watching CNN, the watcher could have read the news crawl at the bottom of the screen. Hodges doesn't have an evidence baggie, but there's a travel-sized pack of Kleenex in his coat pocket. He takes out two, carefully wraps the lens cap, and slips it into the inside pocket of his coat. He rises from the chair, provoking another twinge, the pain is bad this afternoon, then spies something else. Someone has carved a single letter into the wood upright between the two overhead doors, perhaps using a pocket knife. It's the letter Z. 12. They are almost back to the driveway when Hodges is visited by something new. A searing bolt of agony behind his left knee. It feels as if he's been stabbed. He cries out, as much in surprise as from the pain, and bends over, kneading at the throbbing knot, trying to make it let go, to loosen up a little at least. Tom bends down next to him, and thus neither of them sees the elderly Chevrolet cruising slowly along Hilltop Court. Its fading blue paint is dappled with spots of red primer. The old gent behind the wheel slows down even more so he can stare at the two men. Then the Chevrolet speeds up, sending a puff of blue exhaust from its tailpipe, and passes the Ellerton-Stover house headed for the button-hook turnaround at the end of the street.
"What is it?" Tom asks. "What happened?"
"Cramp," Hodges says through gritted teeth.
"Rub it."
Hodges gives him a look of pained humor through his tumbled hair. "What do you think I'm doing?"
"Let me." Tom Sauber is a physical therapy veteran, thanks to his attendance at a certain job fair 6 years ago, pushes Hodges' hand aside. He removes one of his gloves and digs in with his fingers hard.
"Ow! Jesus, that fucking hurts!"
"I know," Tom says. "Can't be helped. Move as much of your weight to your good leg as you can."
Hodges does so.
The Malibu, with its patches of dull red primer paint, cruises slowly by once more, this time headed back down the hill. The driver helps himself to another long look, then speeds up again.
"It's letting go," Hodges says. "Thank God for small favors."
It is, but his stomach is on fire, and his lower back feels like he wrenched it.
Tom is looking at him with concern. "You sure you're all right?"
"Yeah, just a Charlie horse."
"Or maybe a deep vein thrombosis. You're no kid anymore, Bill." You ought to get that checked out. If anything happened to you while you were with me, Pete would never forgive me. His sister either. We owe you a lot.
All taken care of. Got a doctor's appointment tomorrow, Hodges says. Come on, let's get out of here. It's freezing.
He limps the first two or three steps, but then the pain behind his knee lets go entirely and he's able to walk normally. More normally than Tom. Thanks to his encounter with Brady Hartsfield in April of 2009, Tom Sowers will limp for the rest of his life. 13. When Hodges gets home, his stomach is better, but he's dog-tired. He tires easily these days and tells himself it's because his appetite has gotten so lousy, but he wonders if that's really it. He's heard the pain of breaking glass and the boys giving their home run cheer twice on his way back from Ridgedale, but he never looks at his phone while driving, partly because it's dangerous, not to mention illegal in this state, mostly because he refuses to become a slave to it. Besides, he doesn't need to be a mind reader to know from whom at least one of those texts came. He waits until he's hung his coat in the front hall closet, briefly touching the inside pocket to make sure the lens cap is still safe and sound. The first text is from Holly.
We should talk to Pete and Isabel, but call me first. I have a cue.
The other isn't hers. It reads,
Dr. Stamos needs to talk to you urgently. You are scheduled tomorrow at 9 a.m. Please keep this appointment.
Hodges checks his watch and sees that although the stay seems to have lasted at least a month already, it's only 4:15. He calls Stamos's office and gets Marley. He can tell it's her by the chirpy cheerleader's voice, which turns grave when he introduces himself. He doesn't know what those tests showed, but it can't be good. As Bob Dylan once said, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. He bargains for 9:30 instead of 9 because he wants a sit-down with Holly, Pete, and Isabel first. He won't allow himself to believe that his visit to Dr. Stamos's office may be followed by a hospital admission, but he is a realist, and that sudden bolt of pain in his leg scared the shit out of him. Marley puts him on hold. Hodges listens to the young rascals for a while. They must be mighty old rascals by now, he thinks, and then she comes back.
We can get you in at 9:30, Mr. Hodges, but Dr. Stamos wants me to emphasize that it's imperative that you keep this appointment.
How bad is it? He asks before he can stop himself.
I don't have any information on your case, Marley tells him, but I'd say that you should get going on what's wrong as soon as possible, don't you think so?
I do, Hodges says heavily. I'll keep the appointment for sure, and thank you. He breaks the connection and stares at his phone. On the screen is a picture of his daughter at 7, bright and smiling, riding high on the backyard swing he put up when they lived on Freeborn Avenue, when they were still a family. Now Allie's 36, divorced, in therapy and getting over a painful relationship with a man who told her a story as old as Genesis. I'm going to leave her soon, but this is a bad time. Hodges puts the phone down and lifts his shirt. The pain on the left side of his abdomen has subsided to a low mutter again, and that's good, but he doesn't like the swelling he sees below his sternum. It's as if he just put away a huge meal, when in fact he could only eat half his lunch and breakfast was a bagel. What's going on with you? He asks his swollen stomach. I wouldn't mind a clue before I keep that appointment tomorrow. He supposes he could get all the clues he wants by firing up his computer and going to WebMD, but he's come to believe that internet-assisted self-diagnosis is a game for idiots. He calls Holly instead. She wants to know if he found anything interesting at 1588.
Very interesting, as that guy on Laugh-In used to say, but before I go into that, ask your question.
Do you think Pete can find out if Martine Stover was buying a computer? Check her credit cards or something? Because her mother's was ancient. If so, it means she was serious about taking an online course. And if she was serious, then...
Then the chances she was working up to a suicide pact with her mother dropped drastically.
Yes.
But it wouldn't rule out the mother deciding to do it on her own. She could have dumped the pills and vodka down Stover's feeding tube while she was asleep, then got into the tub to finish the job.
But Nancy Alderson said...
They were happy. Yeah, I know. I'm only pointing it out. I don't really believe it.
You sound tired.
Just my usual end-of-the-day slump. I'll perk up after I get some chow.
Never in his life has he felt less like eating.
Eat a lot. You're too thin. But first, tell me what you found in that empty house.
Not in the house. In the garage.
He tells her. She doesn't interrupt.